From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. On the 16th of January, 1979, Mohammad Reza Shah, Emperor of Iran, announced to his people that he was taking a short trip out of the country. He never returned. An Islamic revolution swept Iran. The Ayatollah Khomeini took power. And after a painful year spent wandering in exile, the Shah was dead. 25 years after that flight from Tehran, his widow is telling her story of pageantry, politics, and exile. Tonight on Point, Farah Pahlavi, Empress of Iran. But first, the latest news from Pakistan that Osama bin Laden's number two man may be cornered on the border near Afghanistan. Ayman al-Zawahiri has been on the run since the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in late 2001. Josh Meyer covers intelligence for the Los Angeles Times. He joins us now with the latest. Josh, what are you hearing? What's really known at this hour?
Well, I think you are right to emphasize the maybe part of this, because I think there's a lot of speculation out there. We, meaning the U.S. officials, have been wrong about this kind of stuff frequently in hindsight, but many other times they've been very accurate about it as well. In this case, what they believe is that there's intelligence coming from the Pakistani authorities that the 200 foreign fighters who are pinned down somewhere in the mountains of Waziristan are defending to the death a very high-value al-Qaeda target, and they believe that that target is Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's bin Laden's longtime second in command.
Do you have any idea why they think it's Ayman al-Zawahiri rather than bin Laden himself?
Well, you know, that was one of the first questions I asked people that I talked to here. And what they tell us is that their belief is based on more than the fact that the troops have encountered unusually fierce resistance, the troops meaning the Pakistani troops, but it's based on some kind of intelligence that they can't share with us that does seem to be rather specific. But they also, at the same time, downplay these widespread media reports that you've been hearing that Zawahiri has been positively identified as the quarry, and also that he's certainly that he's been cornered by Pakistani forces in such a way that he might be captured or killed imminently.
So these are Pakistan's troops surrounding these 200-some reportedly al-Qaeda fighters. Any involvement of U.S. forces?
Well, there's sort of a hammer and anvil approach, which is what they've been calling it, in that the Pakistani troops are working their side of the border and that the U.S. troops are working on the Afghan side of the border and that they're going to hopefully catch them one way or the other. One of the big problems of the first time around in the war in Afghanistan was that when we sort of started our bombardment at Tora Bora, that the al-Qaeda troops sort of slipped out the back door and into Pakistan. So this way, we're trying to catch them either way. And right now, it's a couple hours before dawn in Pakistan, so the fighting is expected to resume in a few hours.
Josh, can you describe why there's so much excitement about the possibility that this might be Ayman al-Zawahiri, his role in al-Qaeda?
Well, I mean, you know, I've been following these guys for many, many years, and even before 9/11, Zawahiri was considered by many to be as important as bin Laden, in the sense that bin Laden is sort of the symbolic head of al-Qaeda, but that Zawahiri was the spiritual leader. He headed his own group before sort of merging his group with al-Qaeda. That was called Egyptian Islamic Jihad, and they were a terrorist organization that was considered even more deadly than al-Qaeda for many, many years. He's considered sort of a firebrand orator. He is an operational planner, and I just spoke to Jane Harman, a congresswoman from California who's on the Intelligence Committee, and she said that she can't talk about classified information, but that they believe that that Zawahiri and perhaps not bin Laden are the ones who are really managing some operational controls of al-Qaeda right now.
We've seen high-ranking al-Qaeda officials escape before, famously at Tora Bora.
Right.
Is this an indication that this big spring offensive is working, or is it just too soon to say that? Is this PR?
Yeah, well, I think it's very much too soon to say that. I mean, the more cynical people around here are noting the timing of it, in which Colin Powell is in was in Pakistan today meeting with President Musharraf and other factors, you know, the year anniversary of the Iraq War. But, no, I mean, it's important that they go after al-Qaeda up in the mountains there and that President Musharraf is allowing, you know, there's people that say that he's allowing U.S. troops onto his own soil. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's certainly true that he is forcing his own military to mount a much more aggressive attack against these guys.
Josh, Colin Powell was making news himself in Pakistan today. What did he say, and what was the significance?
Well, I think he was, you know, it was several prongs. I mean, one of them was that he has designated Pakistan as a special sort of status you know, in terms of getting U.S. military aid and getting it quickly.
This is a major ally, second
major
only to
ally,
NATO members.
Right, of non-NATO members. And but also he was talking to Musharraf about the Dr. A.Q. Khan case and the nuclear trafficking case. And, you know, I think U.S. officials would like Pakistan to be a little more forthcoming about how their top nuclear scientist was trafficking in nuclear plants and equipment for many, many years to some of our you know, more dangerous foes like Libya and Iran, and nobody in the Pakistan government ostensibly knew about it. I mean, that's the official line in Pakistan, and I don't think anybody here buys it.
How do those two pieces fit together? On the one hand, Pakistan has just been publicly identified very recently as the hub of what looks like a global nuclear arms trading network. On the other hand, it's elevated to the status of major ally.
And we just gave them $3 billion in military aid. That's a very good question. I've been asking that myself. Well, we clearly need them as a strategic ally in that part of the world. Musharraf is clearly seen as our biggest and best hope. I mean, if he is killed, and they've tried twice in the last couple of months, you know, U.S. officials are deathly afraid that some much more militant government would take over that would be far more sympathetic to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. I mean, Pakistan before 9/11 were one of the few open supporters of the Taliban government.
Well, for now, all eyes on Waziristan and what unfolds there in the next day or two. Josh Meyer, thanks very much for joining us.
Should be interesting.
Should be. Josh Meyer covers intelligence for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us from Washington. On January 16, 1979, Mohammad Reza Shah, the emperor of Iran, boarded a plane with his empress and flew out of Tehran. An Islamic revolution consumed the country, and the exiled Shah wandered from nation to nation looking for shelter from the wrath of the Ayatollahs in Tehran. 26 years earlier, Mohammad Reza Shah had been handed the throne in a 1953 CIA-orchestrated coup. He had married twice but failed to produce a male heir. In 1959, the 39-year-old king met and married the 21-year-old Farah Diba and made her his queen and empress of Iran. For a quarter of a century, the Shah and his queen ruled over a modernizing country, torn between old ways and new. Iran enjoyed its oil wealth, but the country also suffered from growing domestic tension under the Shah's rule, Cold War politics, and rising religious strife. Demonstrations rocked the country in 1979. The Shah fled. A year later, he was dead. Now, after 2.5 decades in exile, his widow is telling her story. This hour on point, Farah Pahlavi, Empress of Iran. As you listen, what do you hear in the story of this empress 25 years later? Is Iran better or worse off than it was under the Shah? And is there a lesson for the United States in the life of Farah Pahlavi and the story of Iran? A lesson about potential pitfalls and unpredictable outcomes, even in Iraq. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Her Majesty Farah Pahlavi, Empress of Iran. Her new memoir is An Enduring Love, My Life with the Shah. Good evening and welcome.
Good evening, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us. And I guess my first question to you is, after all these years, why a memoir now? What inspired, motivated you to write it?
Well, for many years I was thinking to write my story, my life when I was in Iran. And I considered it my duty towards our country, for the memory of my husband, for my children, for my grandchildren, and also the story of a woman which has had a life out of ordinary. And I started to write this book 3 years ago.
3 years ago, a sad and important time in your family's life.
Excuse me. Sorry. Yes, exactly. When my youngest daughter, Leila, was very ill, and I felt so paralyzed and helpless that I had to do something which I considered a duty, and it was then that I started the book, and it was a sort of therapy for me at the same time. And also I needed distance with the event. And also I thought for my compatriots, they needed also a distance with the revolution.
There's a lot of history. We're interested to hear from your perspective tonight. But I guess the question that comes to my mind, first of all, is You were pulled up into this realm of monarchy, and monarchy on quite a grand scale. In those days, Iran had lots of oil wealth. And you lived that life for 20, 25 years. Now you've lived the life of exile and in many ways loss for almost as long. On balance, was it a blessing or a curse to be pulled into the role that came to you as empress?
Well, I always say that life is a struggle for all of us. And we might lose our dear ones, we might lose our country, our home, our position, but we shouldn't lose our hope in the future. We shouldn't lose our dignity. Well, there are so many people out there in the world who have had also a lot of up and downs in their life, joys and sorrow. But I say to myself, I compare myself to many. I have had a part of my life full of joy and satisfaction. And I'm grateful to my husband that in those periods in Iran, he gave me the opportunity as a woman, as his wife, to be active in so many different activities, whether social, cultural, and other things, with the help of so many Iranians, which is a great capital for me, and I felt useful. But at the same time, of course, I have had a very difficult period of exile, as all my compatriots have, above all those who are living in Iran in the last 25 years, and also so many of them who fled the country are living in exile in different parts of the world. So I have been always grateful for what I have. And then to try to get energy from whatever I could, from the love of my children, my friends, or poetry, music, nature, whatever can give me energy for the days that I'm down and depressed.
Let me ask you, those days in 1979, for any Iranian, and for that matter, any American who was alive and aware at that time, the unforgettable times, the images of the Shah and yourself going out, Khomeini coming in, and then the hostages at the U.S. Embassy. We'll look at the history, but I just wonder, when you look at Iran today, after all these years of clerical rule, of Islamic rule, the controversies around the democratic reform and lack of democratic reform there, the controversy right now about Iran being nuclear-armed, what do you think of the path that Iran has taken since you and your husband fled?
Well, of course, we have to compare, and the Iranians compare, whether they're better off then or now. Iran was a land of stability, security, and we were friends with the West. It was in our interest, as well as the Eastern Bloc then. We were friends and good relations with all our neighbors, and we were going forward, developing, progressing, and towards modernity. So many changes has happened in the Iranian society, but unfortunately, these last 25 years, which I call 25 dark years of parentheses in the 25th century of our history, it's heartbreaking for all of us, and not only for us, but look what has happened after the Islamic Republic took power. The Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the Taliban, the Iran-Iraq war, the Gulf War, and now all the trouble in the Middle East. And Iran is important not only for Iranians, but for the Middle East and for the rest of the world. And the majority of Iranians lately in the so-called elections have proven that 70% of them, even more, are against this regime. The Islamic Republic has lost its legitimacy. It doesn't have any more messages to deliver. And Iranian people, especially the women and the young people, want freedom, want democracy, and want the separation of religion with government.
We want to come back and hear much more about your personal story. We're talking tonight with an empress in exile, Farah Pahlavi, the wife of the deposed Shah of Iran. You can join the conversation. Do you remember the Islamic Revolution in Iran, 1979? What images have stuck with you of the Shah, his empress? And where did your sympathies lie in 1979 with the Shah, with the protesters in the streets of Tehran? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight with Her Imperial Majesty Empress Farah Pahlavi, the wife of the deposed Shah of Iran. Her new memoir is An Enduring Love, My Life with the Shah. You can join the conversation. What light do the stories of an empress in exile shed on Iran today, on Iraq and the Middle East today? Can you imagine being 39 years old in 1979 and then an empress in exile for a quarter century? What do you hear in Farah Pahlavi's telling of history? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I wonder if you can tell us something about your early life, what kind of family you came from, how you came to be the wife, the empress of the Shah of Iran.
Well, before, Tom, I wanted to ask you for that short, beautiful Persian music which took me back home.
we'll get it to you.
Thank you. It's beautiful. And also, in your introduction, you mentioned 1953 and my husband returning to Iran and the involvement of CIA. I wanted to say that in those periods, if it was not the will of the Iranian people and many of the religious leaders, my husband could not be back to Iran. I just wanted to give my side of the story on that.
Well, perhaps, though, you know, we've talked with people who were directly involved with the operations in those days, and the CIA did have a central role as well.
Well, of course, in those days, with the problem which arose, although we were very proud of our nationalization of oil and proud of what Dr. Mossadegh had done, but I understand that the United States did not want Iran to fall into the hand of communism, and there were many communist infiltration in our army. And also, if Dr. Mossadegh then had shown some flexibility and considering the power of the world powers and the strength of Iran, maybe there wouldn't have been this shift between us Iranians. But I think the CIA has taken too much credit for what happened in Iran, although they were in favor that Iran should not fall into the hand of communism.
I guess as you respond to it, I'm moved to ask, was this something that bothered the Shah, your husband? Has it always bothered you that the CIA authorship is often or always appended to the origin of his time on the throne?
Exactly, because as I said, if it was not for the will of the Iranian people, this would not have happened. Even some very close friends of Dr. Mossadegh did not approve of his approach in those days. But of course, this has been used by all the opposition to the monarchy and to my husband to repeat this 53 event.
And of course, 25 years later, there was a mob at the gates. But I want to understand for our listeners something about your early history, if you'd be good enough to share it with us. Your family, how you came into the realm of the Shah, how you came to be his wife.
Well, you know, as I've written in my book, I was brought up in a family which was without really values of our tradition, at the same time very open to education. I always say that we were part of young people of the Pahlavi era. We had opportunities in front of them, and we were having, even if we didn't have all the facilities that the children have, we had happy childhood, many of us. And after I was studying architecture in Paris, and I came to Tehran in 59 for my summer vacation, and I met the Shah's son-in-law from his first marriage. Mm-hmm. He had a daughter, and this gentleman was taking care of students abroad, and I wanted to get a scholarship. My uncle was working for the king, and he introduced me to him, and he wanted me to meet his wife, Princess Shahnaz.
This is the wife of the son-in-law?
Yes.
And the daughter of the Shah?
The daughter of the Shah, mm-hmm, from his first marriage to Princess Fauzia of, mm-hmm, Egypt. Mm-hmm. And then when I was there, suddenly the king appears. Of course, my heart was beating. I always admired him. I always loved him. and to see him from so close, and he put me so much at ease, and we sat and we spoke very naturally. He asked me questions about my studies and so on, and then meetings continued, different days, a different occasion, more conversation, and this admiration and love of a young girl to her king was transforming into the love of a woman to a man, till the day we were both alone and he asked me to marry him. And I, of course, immediately I said yes. I was happy, I loved him, I was proud. And the first thing he told me was, as a queen, you would have responsibility towards your country and your compatriot.
You describe a whirlwind romance, a kind of a remarkable, I don't know what to call it, a date where the Shah asked you over to his place for a swim with him in his private pool. He had had two wives but no son. Did you have the feeling you were being sized up as the potential mother of a son as quick as possible?
Well, you know, frankly, maybe later on I thought about that, but in those days or months, I didn't think that is that reason, because I knew that he wouldn't have married me if he didn't have any sentiment or he didn't love me, and he had said it so on different occasions. And as a young woman, I didn't even think that maybe I will not be able to have a child. But coming back to my student years in Paris, I remember when there were news in the newspapers that the Shah wants to get a new wife, and there were pictures of young Iranian ladies and some foreign princesses. My school friends were telling me, why not you? You're cute. And I said, well, why don't you write to the Shah? And we were just joking about it. And he said, what happens if you become a queen? Then I said, I will invite you all to visit our country, which I did, of course, afterwards.
You did produce that male heir within just, I don't know, 9, 10, 11 months after your marriage.
Yes.
And went on to sit at the side of the Shah as he ruled over a time of rapid modernization, a lot of oil wealth, and ultimately a lot of tension in Iranian society. Looking back all these years later, where did that tension come from, the tension that ultimately boiled over into the Islamic Revolution?
Well, it was a mixture of so many things, because progress and modernity broke some tradition, and some could not adapt, and others were impatient, and there was rising expectation that the government could not meet. And also all the students we had abroad, over 100,000 students, there was a shift of class, because they were coming from different parts of Iran, and when they saw these beautiful, advanced countries, they wondered why not our country, and they were always taken by the group of opposition. And also some people were unhappy about the social opening, like land reform, which made landowners unhappy, and especially the women's emancipation and their freedom didn't please many religious leaders. And also Iran, it was during the Cold War, and the vision of the Soviet Union always to reach the warm water of the Persian Gulf, and groups of opposition who were believing that the ideal system is the communist China or the Soviet Union, and different extremist group, and also all that. And, you know, one foot you put forward, there are problems which arises, and you have to deal with this problem. Now, I look back now with hindsight, if there was more political participation of people, which my husband believed in, because Iran was in the middle of, in the Middle Ages, in the beginning of 20th century, and came rapidly to develop. And all that created problem, and now with hindsight, if it was more political participation, maybe this would not have happened. Of course, having said that, all those groups who were extreme left, and some of them trained in Libya, Lebanon, and Cuba, they wanted change of system, and even the Islamic fundamentalists.
Which
but I think for the rest of the people.
I want to ask you especially now when there are so many Americans in Iraq. America is so engaged, deeply engaged there. There was a time when America's alliance, the Washington support of the Shah, was so deep and so strong. I remember vividly as a very young man traveling in the Middle East in the mid-70s, mid-late 70s, being in Tehran and feeling a kind of anti-Americanism there in the streets, anti-Western sentiment in the streets that was palpable and was unlike anything I felt in countries that were not as close to the United States. Was the U.S. a good ally for the Shah? Was it a good ally for Iran? What was the origin of what ultimately emerged as the deep anger toward the United States, the great Satan?
Excuse me, what years were you...
I was passing through Tehran in 1976.
Yes, that was close to the revolution. It was in the interest of Iran to be allied with the West and with America. And I believe that in those periods, Iran, which was friendly also with the Eastern Bloc then and all our neighbors and the rest of the world, the country was going forward. And I don't think Iranians really had any anti-Western sentiments or even anti-American, because we have never been a colony of any country.
But I wonder, so, I felt it in the streets, and only a handful of years later, Americans were held hostage in the U.S. Embassy. We all remember the huge crowds in the streets chanting against the great Satan, the United States.
Well, this is the enemies the Islamic Republic want to find outside to blame all the problems on them. And let's not forget that the group extreme left, which were anyway against America, and they were always criticizing the so-called capitalist Western imperialism. But all those people who joined Khomeini for the revolution, and Khomeini used them, and after he succeeded, got rid of them in a very terrible way, they didn't go back to Soviet Union or China. They are all living now in the Western capitalist nations. So it was a propaganda mostly of the communist ideology and also the fundamentalist.
When did you know inside the palace walls that Islamic fundamentalism, Islamic revolution was going to sweep over Iran, sweep you and your husband out of the palace, out of Iran?
As I have written in my book, maybe a year earlier, I was feeling that it's not the same relation anymore. Of course we had shortcomings. Of course we should have handled and addressed the problems otherwise. And if there was time, my husband wanted to bring more opening into the society, political participation. But in our countries, we cannot become overnight democracies. The other countries have decades behind them to be real democracies. But, you know, everything joined in their hands. I can maybe, as I say again, there was more opening, more political participation. This would not have happened. But when the problem started, nobody believed that it will end this way. I believe that after 1963, what we call the White Revolution, the basis of a just society was set. And then but Iran was going ahead. And unfortunately, you know, people and countries sometimes are fooled by promises, like many Iranians were, because those who were working for the religious leader were giving an image that he's a holy man, that he will believes in human right and women's right, and they were working out of America and out of Europe. And also there was, at the period in the 70s, there was a lot of campaign vilifying the Shah and the monarchy, and also...
I remember it well, in ranks of Iranian students abroad standing with paper bags over their heads from fear of, professed fear, in any case, of the Shah's secret service. Safak, we have a lot of callers who want to join us, and I want to invite them in. We're talking with the Empress in Exile, Farah Pahlavi, author of the new book, An Enduring Love. Reza is calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Reza, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Nice show. I came to United States January 6th of 1979.
About the same time that the Empress and Shah were leaving Tehran?
Yes, almost. At the time, I was against the regime of Shah, but didn't take that long, just how sorry I was that they left the country, and a lot of people are sorry that what happened in Iran. People just...
Reza, why were you against the Shah then, and how do you feel about Iran now?
I was against Shah at the time because there was a lot of... I was young at the time. I was 19 years old, and probably we didn't know better everywhere we went because of the religious... A lot of religious pressure in Iran, and people were just, you know, believing in religious people. And that's why we were against, without knowingly, we were against Shah. After all these years, that's what I can say to myself. Without even any knowledge, knowingly, we were against it.
And Reza, the Empress is on the air with you. What would you say to her today?
I wish I could say that, please, somehow, you know, we are sorry. A lot of people are sorry. I wish that she could go back. Reza, his son Reza, could go back. Iran needs a leader. We need to go back where we were 25 years ago. What Shah has started it. It was taking us pretty good. We just didn't know better.
Reza, thank you very much for your call. Farah Pahlavi, how do you respond?
Thank you, Reza. You touched me and you almost brought tears to my eyes. But I hope for you that you will return to your country and our country will become free and democratic, and especially you young people go back. And of course, in those days, Khomeini promised paradise and he opened the door to hell. And Reza, I wish you a very happy Nowruz, so we are near our new year.
Persian New Year's tomorrow, this weekend.
Yes.
We're talking tonight with Her Imperial Majesty Empress Farah Pahlavi, the wife of the deposed Shah of Iran. You can join the conversation. What do you hear in Farah Pahlavi's telling of history? Where does the U.S.-Iran relationship go next? And does the story of the Shah shed any light on potential pitfalls in Iraq today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Her new book is An Enduring Love, My Life with the Shah. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Her Imperial Majesty, Empress Farah Pahlavi, the wife of the deposed Shah of Iran. Her new memoir is An Enduring Love, My Life with the Shah. You can join the conversation. Do you remember the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979? Could events again spin out of Washington's control in neighboring Iraq, as they did in Tehran 25 years ago? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Paul is calling from Poyet, Wisconsin. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Why, thank you very much for taking the call, and Empress, it's a pleasure to talk to you. My question maybe is twofold. The first part of it is there's not been much talk about the religious aspect of the entire revolution in Iran, and it seems the crux of the problem, unless I'm mistaken. I was a young man at the time. I was in my 30s, and I seem to pay attention to the religious end of it. That is, could we ever bridge the gap between the kind of Christian Judeo thought process with the Islamic thought process? Because that seems to be a fundamental issue between the quote-unquote politics of the situation. And I might ask the Empress if she'd address the religious aspect. And can some kind of bridge be built between the different religious beliefs in the area? Because again, it seems to me to be a fundamental issue.
Right at the heart of things. Paul, thank you for your question. Farah Pahlavi.
Yes, good evening, Paul. I believe that we must do something, of all of us and religious people belonging to different religion, to come together, to get together. And I say that in Iran, the groups who went with the religious leader with the false hope that they will take power, and of course the religious fundamentalists used them. But when I say that in so many years, 1,400 years, the Muslim have lived more or less in peace with other religion, and especially in our country, which was very tolerant towards, we had different religious minorities, and we lived in peace and we had respect about each other. And what has happened in Iran, especially in the last 25 years, the Iranian people have tasted the regime. And unfortunately, our religion has regressed in Iran, and the many religious people have lost their respect. And many religious leaders are against what's happening in Iran with the Islamic Republic today. I think it's up to people, and especially to religious people of different religions, to get together to discuss and to really talk about the real values of every religion, which is more or less the same in every religion. And these groups are just fundamentalists working for their own political and material power. And this is what I believe, after what I've seen and hear, is happening in Iran.
But Empress, you've seen the very wide appeal of Islamic fundamentalist leaders, an appeal that seems to be growing. You must read, as we do, the talk now about a clash on the scale of the Crusades, a clash of civilizations. It seems that the fundamentalist face of Islam is the one that's most in the face of the West.
Well, unfortunately, you know, after what has happened in Iran, for 25 years, almost the world closed their eyes of what's happening. And unfortunately, it all grew in other Muslim countries after the Iranian Revolution, although fundamentalist group existed. And nobody paid attention in a way. But what can I say, that we have to keep hope that this really movement, which is so dangerous for the whole world, will calm down. It has to, for the future of our children and grandchildren.
When you look across the border at Iraq, do you fear or do you imagine an Islamic government emerging there, or do you see it potentially as on the track, the path to the kind of democracy that the United States is clearly hoping for?
Well, I hope for Iraq that with the help of the Iraqi people, they will gain their popular sovereignty and keep their integrity. But coming back to Iran, and I hope if the world supports these freedom-loving people of Iran, it will have an effect on other Muslim countries, because the Iranian people have tasted this regime. And we know that Iran has become the center of international terrorism and religious fundamentalism, and they are helping other fundamentalist group and terrorist group, and also show them no hope because they want to stay there no matter what.
Hamid is calling from Westford, Massachusetts. Hi, Hamid. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Actually, I have one comment and one question.
Mm-hmm.
I was born before a revolution, and I remember Shah's era. And the way that I like to dispute the fact that we were on the path of modernization before revolution. I mean, the fact that these guys that are running right now Iran are bad doesn't mean that Shah's regime was good. I mean, Shah's regime was as bad as these guys, if it's not worse.
As bad in what terms? I mean, clearly it was very controversial at the time.
In terms of political oppression,
mm-hmm.
in terms of human development, practically.
So I guess that when people say modernization, they point to oil refineries and roads and
no,
that.
In fact, I like to dispute that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there was no road, no airport, no universities, no communications. I mean, you can talk to older people. Probably Tehran had the capital had some facilities, but if you went outside Tehran, practically there was none. I remember Shah's prime minister, Hoveyda, at the time, I was surprised at the time. He was saying, we have so much money. Exactly, this was his word. We have so much money that we don't know what to do with it. And the country was completely underdeveloped. And saying this kind of stuff was really embarrassing.
So you're saying emperors don't take too much credit for those days? In your view, they weren't so great?
No. The people had money. People had purchasing power. But the infrastructure was a disaster.
Hamid, thanks for your call. Empress Farah Pahlavi, we just have another minute.
Well, I'm very sorry for Hamid. If he thinks that under the Islamic Republic the country has gone forward, I wonder why he's not back there. But what can I say? It's so one-sided. I mean, everybody in the whole world, and especially the Iranian people, know what was Iran in those years. To give you an example, $1 was 70 rial, today is 8,000 rial. The per capita income was $2,500 25 years ago, and today, after so much oil revenue, is below 1,000. And what do you mean there is no university, no roads? I mean, I don't know this gentleman to which ideology he belongs. But universities were built, the children had free education, all the Iranian children even had health certificate. What about the condition of women, the freedom, the family protection law? So many students abroad, so many Iranians, hundreds of the men and women who worked, roads and development and communication and agriculture.
Farah Pahlavi, our time is almost up. I must ask you one last question. Do you have any aspirations for your son to sit on the throne in Iran again as Shah, or is all that history now?
Well, no, my son has been fighting for 24 years with so many Iranians of different political opinion for freedom and democracy.
But can you picture him back in Tehran as a ruler?
He has said he's ready to serve his country any way his people choose, by a referendum, whether a constitutional monarchy or any sort of democratic government. But before we finish, I want to seize this occasion again to tell you that all those Americans who lived in Iran in those days, if you can ask them, I wish they had called. They had a wonderful life in Iran. They loved the country and they didn't feel any animosity. And especially before finishing, to wish a very happy Nowruz to all my compatriots who listened to me, and to tell to Hamid again, if we didn't have an airport, how did I? We flew back out of Iran.
You did. And so many. You did fly
so many,
out.
I mean, the army Iran had, the pilots, they were stars in Acrojet, my God.
Empress, with that, I'm afraid we have to say goodbye, but I want to thank you for being with us tonight. And
goodbye,
and,
Tom.
And for your
thank
book.
You for having me, and please remember to send me some of this beautiful Persian music.
And a happy Persian New Year to all of our Persian listeners. Farah Pahlavi, Empress in Exile of Iran, author of the new memoir, An Enduring Love, My Life with the Shah. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the Medicare mess in Washington. This is On Point. Months after the controversial Medicare drug coverage bill narrowly passed in Congress, Democrats today called for an investigation into whether the White House hid the true cost of the program. Medicare's chief actuary, Richard Foster, estimated the government would spend $550 billion over 10 years, far more than the $400 billion estimate that Congress was given. According to the New York Times, Foster was told by his boss, Thomas Scully, that he would be fired if he shared the higher, honest estimate. This after news that the Department of Health and Human Services gave out propaganda videos, in effect, to TV stations praising the drug program. Cheryl Gay Stolberg has been covering the Medicare bill story for the New York Times. She joins me now from Chevy Chase, Maryland. Cheryl, there's a whole set of concerns about how this legislation was presented and passed. Can you outline them for us?
Yes, there are a whole set of concerns. Although, first off, I'd take issue with your characterization of this higher estimate as being honest. The fact is that no one knows what the correct estimate is.
But honest in the sense that it was the estimate that they had reached.
It was indeed the estimate that the Bush administration had reached, and it did contrast with the estimate that the Congressional Budget Office reached, which was $400 billion over 10 years. And that is, of course, one of the key concerns right now surrounding the Medicare bill. What was the true cost? The other concerns involve allegations of bribery on the House floor. Representative Nick Smith, a Republican from Michigan, has alleged that some lawmakers tried to induce him into voting in favor of the measure by promising financial assistance to his son's congressional campaign. And there are also concerns about the videos that the Health and Human Services Department is using to try to promote, or they might say educate, consumers about the new Medicare bill.
And what exactly is the complaint about the videos?
Well, these videos are cast as video news releases, and in essence, they show reporters or actors portraying reporters trying to describe the new Medicare bill in terms that are quite favorable to it. And they'll say something like, "This is Karen Richards reporting from Washington."
And the hope was that this would go right on the evening television news.
Right on the evening news, exactly. These videos were prepared by the government, scripts written by the government. The reporters aren't really reporters. They're actors paid to read these government-sponsored scripts.
Cheryl, we're hearing today about Democrats calling for an investigation, but the bill is already passed. Is there anything that will really happen here to reverse that, or what's done is done?
Well, the bill is already passed. Some Democrats are calling for a revote. Frankly, I think that's unlikely. But as you might know, the Republicans were hoping that this Medicare bill would be a political plus for them this year. Democrats, of course, are trying to blunt that. It is possible that if controversy grows over the bill, that it could be revised or changed.
Even conservative Republicans must be concerned about the apparent great underestimation of the cost of the bill.
Well, they are concerned. Many conservative Republicans are up in arms over the rising federal deficit, and they were not happy, frankly, about voting for the $400 billion bill. So any suggestion that the bill would have cost more than that is obviously not met with happy faces among Republicans on Capitol Hill.
But they, on the other hand, are not likely to give much cooperation to Democrats who want to make this a campaign issue against the president.
No, I don't think so. They'd like to stay in power.
What's the next step? When will we know if there's any traction with this, or is this a five-day headline and gone?
Well, we'll see how things develop. The actuary, Mr. Foster, is in fact scheduled to testify on Capitol Hill next week in a previously scheduled hearing. He makes a regular annual appearance on the Hill, and there's no doubt that if he does appear, Democrats will try to grill him about what happened. Already, Tommy Thompson, the Health and Human Services Secretary, has ordered his Inspector General to investigate Mr. Foster's claims that his boss, or former boss, threatened to fire him if he released these estimates.
So much more to come with that. We've got to go. Cheryl Gay-Stolberg, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.